Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Stephen Sewer, your chair for tonight's program, and I would like to welcome you to the keynote address of the For Richer, For Poorer, Surviving and Thriving in the Great Recession program series. Our speaker this evening is Gary Schlossberg, vice president and senior economist with Wells Capital Management. In this month-long series, which was conceived by Dr. Carol Fleming, the Commonwealth Club will examine many aspects of the profound economic dislocation we have experienced since the fall of 2007. The Great Recession, the worst since the Great Recession of the 1930s, produced extraordinary action on the part of policymakers, corporations, and families as we struggled to cope with the financial panic and fear. Our aim with this platform is to reflect on what has happened, offer ideas and insight on how to cope, and to light the path forward. For Richer, For Poorer, Surviving and Thriving in the Great Recession has been generously underwritten by Wells Fargo Bank. Tonight, the Commonwealth Club of California is delighted and honored to present our keynote speaker for the For Richer, For Poorer series, Gary Schlossberg, Vice President and Senior Economist with Wells Capital Management. Gary Schlossberg honed his skills as an economist while doing his graduate work at Pennsylvania State University, where he earned a master's in economics. In his early career, Gary worked as a researcher at the United States Treasury and the Federal Reserve Board, working on matters pertaining to international economic conditions and public policy. Today, Gary is the economic face for Wells Fargo & Company. He has worked for the firm for 35 years, and his current position is with Wells Capital Management, where he is vice president and works as a senior economist. In his role, he analyzes the economic and investment environment to provide senior management, team members, and clients critical insights for decision-making and policy formulation. He is a senior member of several key investment policy committees with Wells Capital and Wells Fargo's Wealth Management Group. He presents to groups throughout the country regarding the equity and fixed income markets, as well as foreign exchange and international capital markets. He appears frequently on financial radio and business television programs in the United States, Japan, and the United Kingdom. When he is not crunching data and drawing charts, Gary enjoys golf and cycling. Gary lives in Marin with his wife, Lisa, and he has a daughter attending the University of Oregon. Go Ducks. Please welcome to our rostrum, Gary Schlossberg. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm thrilled, honored to participate in this series of discussions on the recession, surviving and thriving. I'd like to know who of you is thriving in this sort of environment, but certainly it's a pleasure to participate. As an analyst, I think we'd certainly prefer to have the advantage of time, wait a bit, so that we could get better perspective on just what we've been through, what we will be going through over the next year or so. But these are bread and butter issues, and of course, people are vitally interested in what's going on now, where we're going over the next year, next couple of years, what it means for our investments, the value of our homes. These are issues that are really near and dear to our heart. And I must say that in the 35 years I've been with the bank, I've never been busier. The audiences have never been as active as they have been in terms of questions, issues. The urgency seems to be a good deal greater. I think it's really a reflection of the kind of environment that we're in. As Stephen mentioned, we are navigating one of the most difficult financial crises, economic crises, since the 1930s Depression. The recession already is the longest and deepest on record. The financial markets came very close to collapse, about as close to collapse as we've seen in the last 70, 75 years. And without the help of the government, I guess, we could have very well faced a disaster even greater than what we're experiencing right now. Part of this program was to look back and try to assess how we got here. generally, we try to avoid that. Looking back, trying to assign blame seems to be counterproductive. But in this instance, I think it could very well be useful. If we're able to evaluate, if we're able to fully determine, get a good read of where the responsibility for the problems lie, I think we come up with, certainly the policymakers can, with the right mix of changes to our regulations, trying to avoid overregulation, which can be damaging to economic growth, underregulating, leaving us exposed to the same sort of volatility that we experienced over the past couple of years. In fact, there is a commission headed by California's own Phil Angelides that is meeting. It's a bipartisan commission that is meeting to discuss the whole crisis, the evolution of the crisis, hopefully with the view of laying things out, providing the right kinds of insights so that we can come up with the right policy mix of changes to reduce the volatility, to reduce the chances that something like this can develop in the future. In looking back, to me, this was a team effort. You don't get into a mess like this with just one part of the economy, just one group of individuals, one sector of the economy fouling up. To me, it really starts, and it is all arguable. You'll get a debate on both sides of the ledger. But to me, it really started with the government. The same government that saved us from a real severe crisis, to me, really laid out the environment that encouraged the sort of excesses that created the sort of instability that we've experienced over the last 12 to 18 months. It really starts with the Federal Reserve, in my view, keeping monetary policy too loose, too easy for too long. Low interest rates, as investors, encouraged people to reach for yield, dissatisfied with high-quality, plain vanilla investments, reaching out to higher-risk investments in the junk bond market, in emerging markets, at the extreme, into derivatives. And banks certainly obliged the financial engineers on Wall Street, coming up with complex financial assets, very opaque, difficult to assess, more unstable than many of us had anticipated. The rating agencies dropped the ball to some extent, didn't fully understand the assets that they were rating, assigned a high rating, encouraging people to jump into the market, fueling the excesses that we saw. In the housing area, low funding costs encouraged people to move into real estate. For a time, certainly a sound rally in the housing market for a period, but then the speculation began to develop. The excesses began to develop as more and more people piled in, and we moved from homeowners to speculators moving in, trying to anticipate further increases in prices. Banks, flush with liquidity, did get a bit greedy themselves. And we knew the beginning of the end, in retrospect, was at hand when banks moved from income-based lending, evaluating the credit quality of the borrower, to asset-based lending, basically riding the run-up in prices in real estate in a booming market and lending to individuals that soon became stretched. I might add that the government, in addition to the liquidity it provided, also made the mistake of not adequately policing the regulations that were already at hand. We had regulations fostering transparency in many of these mortgages, transparency in some of these financial products. And for whatever reason, the Federal Reserve and other regulatory authorities didn't police those laws that were already on the books. The result was an excess leveraging in the economy, the likes of which we haven't seen since the late 20s, just prior to the Great Depression, and that set the stage for a collapse. I would say the defining event in that collapse was the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers in September. As recently as the middle of last year, we were still debating whether or not the economy was in a recession. The economy was holding up remarkably well to a series of body blows, any one of which in the past has precipitated a downturn, a severe recession. Oil prices were rising at a rapid clip. Home values were beginning to roll over to some extent, eating into household wealth. And we saw losses in some of the other financial assets as well. Through it all, the economy was moving sideways, but all things considered, holding up quite well. It was the collapse of Lehman Brothers, an accident waiting to happen, really. If it wasn't Lehman Brothers, it probably would have been something else. But the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers rippled through the financial markets. Most importantly, it created losses at money funds, severe enough so that one or two money funds, ironically, one of them was managed by an individual who was credited with inventing the concept itself, The losses were great enough that these money funds had to announce that they were breaking the buck, which meant that the dollar that you put into a money fund that you assume is as good as a CD would no longer be worth a dollar as it was withdrawn. That triggered a flight to quality, in effect a run like a run on a bank. People redeemed their funds, their assets in those money funds. The withdrawal meant in meeting that redemption activity that the money funds had to go into the money market and liquidate their holdings of commercial paper and a whole array of other short-term securities. That dried up short-term lending. And make no mistake about it, credit is the lifeblood of economic growth. It's the lubrication that keeps things going. We take it for granted because 99% of the time it's there. The only variable is its cost. Every once in a while, like last fall and earlier this year, credit completely dries up and things shut down. We had another example of that back in 1980. The Carter administration announced credit controls in March of 1980. Immediately, because of the confusion that created, everybody hoarded cash against the possibility that they wouldn't have that credit when they needed it. And if you look back on the data, that one quarter immediately after those credit controls were enacted was the steepest one quarter decline in the last 50 years, steeper than anything we saw during the severe recessions in the mid-1970s and again in the early 1980s. Fortunately, the administration was able to come back in July of that year and simply say, whoops, sorry about that, rescind the controls, and the economy came roaring back for a short time before falling into that very deep, long recession in 1981-82. But the problems this time around are a good deal more severe, a good deal more fundamental. Where are we now? Well, while we're debating the responsibility over who caused what and whose responsibility it was, the more immediate issue is just where we are in this whole cycle. As I said, the economy is slowly emerging from this very trying period. In fact, by all accounts, we're either very close to the end of this very long, severe recession, or we're already past it. Our guess is that the recession, in retrospect, will have ended in July of this year. The best news is centering on those leading-edge sectors of the economy like housing and autos. Forward-looking indicators like the index of leading indicators have been rising for several months now. It looks like the economy is making a turn. And news even better than that is that the bounce out of this recession for a quarter or so will probably be even stronger than many of us anticipated. I might add just parenthetically that California, as was the case during the recession in the early 90s and again in 2001, probably will be late to the party. Our recession was more severe than those in most other parts of the country. The strength or weakness of a local economy in this economic cycle was determined very much by the housing cycle. And of course, as you probably know, we had more than our share of speculation in the housing industry, and the collapse was that much more severe. And the ripple effects were that much more severe. Here in California, the slowdown led by the Central Valley and Southern California has become more uniform. As this slowdown has become more pervasive, as the recession has become more severe, the Bay Area has caught up in the midst of a slowdown every bit as bad as it is in the other two parts of the California economy. Now, typically, we rely on so-called export industries to pull us out of an economic slump. Export industries are any activity whose revenues, the bulk of whose revenues, are derived mainly outside the local economy. So it could be sales overseas, it could be sales outside of California. If it's the Bay Area, it could be sales to other parts of California. What are those industries? Telecommunications, high tech, agribusiness, the motion picture industry, the entertainment industry, travel, tourism, and pervading, transcending all that, are ties to the Asian area, the Asian economy, which is going to be very important, I think, for California down the road because Asia is recovering much sooner than most other parts of the world. But California will be late to the game. Our recession was more severe. Our recovery, we think, will be a good deal slower. Now, looking ahead, not only is the bounce a bit stronger than expected, but the ingredients for a very powerful recovery are there. In fact, the rule of thumb is the more severe the recession, the stronger the recovery that follows. If you look back in the early 1980s, the very long, deep recession that we suffered then was followed by a very powerful recovery in 1983 and early 1984. Much the same situation in the mid-1970s, the recession in 1973 to 75, followed by a period of very strong growth in 1976, at least for a short interval. As I said, the ingredients are in place for just that sort of occurrence this time around. For one thing, there is a lot of pent-up demand out there, pent-up consumer demand. We did spend in excess during the housing boom, drawing on those gains in home equity, home values, in fostering a very strong period of growth in consumer spending. But so great has the cutback been in spending as the economy rolled over that, by our estimate, pent-up demand is about as strong now, nearly as strong, as it was at the end of the recession in 1982. Secondly, unlike the situation in the mid-70s and again in the early 80s, we don't have high double-digit inflation. We don't have double-digit interest rates that have been coming down a bit. Plenty of liquidity out there, plenty of money in the financial markets. It's ironic. We're in a credit squeeze, but it's a credit squeeze because money has moved to the sidelines. It's still available, and we've seen the power of it in different sectors of the economy. In the stock market, for example, the very powerful rally that we experienced in between March and mid-June, and again in the early part of July, right up through the last few days, fueled in part by the release of all these money fund assets. Money moved back into these money funds. That's a traditional parking vehicle in the stock market. Give you an idea of how much money is out there. Typically, money fund assets are about 15% of the market capitalization for the stock market as a whole. At their peak, money fund assets were the equivalent of 53, 54%. They've since moved down to 34% of the capitalization of the stock market. Still plenty of cash out there. And there is cash available for lending to individuals and businesses if the spigots can open up. And in fact, the plumbing is being freed. The financial markets are thawing out from this very severe credit freeze. They're still dysfunctional. Credit is still very tight. But we're moving in the right direction. And if that thaw continues, at some point, credit should become increasingly available, helping to foster economic growth. On top of that, tremendous fiscal stimulus out there. And this stimulus has been backloaded. We've criticized the administration, the president, for too much money being spent for the amount of stimulus we're getting, and I can comment on that a little bit later. But one of the problems also is that only about 25 cents of every dollar of stimulus will be spent this year when it's needed most. The good news, though, is that in a slow economic recovery, we still have 75 cents of every dollar from that original stimulus package that will be spent in 2010 and 2011, another source of support for an economy as it emerges from a very difficult situation. Despite all the strengths out there, we still look for an unusually mild recovery, a bit stronger than what we saw in 2002 after the 2001 recession, and again after the mild recession in 1990-91. We went through a difficult period as well. You may recall the term jobless recovery. What recovery? We could very well be saying the same thing this time around as well, but all the more remarkable following the severe recession. Why do we look for a mild recovery? There are just too many restraints out there, unusual, but too many of them, that we think will offset some of those positives. Most of it has to do with the aftermath of the credit freeze. If you look at history, when we do have weak, drawn-out recoveries, even after a deep recession, tends to be associated with a crunch, financial turmoil, that restrains economic activity coming out of the recession, moving into the recovery. And that's just what we're faced with this time around. Foreclosure activity remains high. We expect it to remain high in the housing industry. That has the effect of adding supply to the market, depressing prices to some extent. There is a silver lining there. It does improve housing affordability, and we've seen some evidence of the impact as housing demand picks up. Here in California, for example, home sales are up about 70% from their year-ago level. But the foreclosure activity has an unsettling effect on credit quality, on the supply of homes. Secondly, household wealth has taken a hit, the likes of which we haven't seen since the 1930s. The loss of wealth from the 1-2 punch, from home values declining and the stock market coming down, means that households will have to work harder, divert more of their income towards savings, replenishing that wealth, and spending less. We don't think spending is going to shut down, but it will have the effect, perhaps, of diluting that consumer-led recovery, which is really essential to get the economy back on a growth track. Consumers are the proverbial 600-pound gorilla out there. They account for 2/3 of total spending. As the consumer goes, so goes the economy. Mild growth in consumer spending should set the tone for a mild recovery. And lastly, the hit to the financial sector from all this financial turbulence has been far greater than anything we've seen since the 1930s. Now, typically, at this stage in the cycle, we see banks pulling in their horns. They're rebuilding their balance sheets, a little more reluctant to lend because of concern about credit quality as the unemployment rate is rising, and trying to fix their own balance sheets. They're taking losses during the recession, and they're trying to build up their capital again so that they're positioned to lend as economic conditions improve. And in fact, the economy can recover even if bank lending is restrained. Fortunately, this is the least credit-sensitive part of the economic cycle. Businesses tend to finance more of their investment and inventory spending through their internally generated cash flow. Households rely on more on their own income to foster consumer spending, to generate gains in consumer spending. The problem is, this time around, the hit to financial institutions has been so great, and it will be substantial in the next year. Typically, credit quality continues to deteriorate. Loan losses continue to rise into the first year of an economic recovery. And we're already seeing the number of bank failures rising at an accelerated rate, and we expect to see more of that in the next year. The bigger problems likely to be among small and mid-sized banks, more heavily exposed to commercial real estate. But what that means is that banks may be more reluctant to lend than they normally are, and the pullback may last longer, and we think that will weigh on the economy as well. Another problem, another restraint on growth, is the unusual nature of this interest rate and inflation cycle. We talk about the business cycle, but really superimposed on that are a whole series of other cycles that tend to behave in a typical way in tandem with the ups and downs in the economy. We have an inflation cycle, we have a profit cycle, we have a bank lending cycle, which is going true to form right now. We have a credit quality cycle as well. And the interest rate cycle typically is one in which interest rates peak early in a recession, along with inflation, and then the Fed breaks the back of inflation, breaking a fever, if you will, tightening up, raising interest rates up, driving them up into the early recession period. That slows the economy. Inflation comes down, and with it, interest rates move lower through the recession, and that extends right into the early recovery period. This time around, we never really had a big run-up of inflation for reasons I'll be glad to discuss with you. Inflation started at a relatively low level. That, plus all the turmoil in the financial markets, the flight to quality into Treasury securities, drove those rates down to an extraordinarily low level. How low? Treasury bill rates at one point in the secondary market were negative. People were willing, in effect, to pay a fee for a guaranteed loss on a Treasury rather than the unknown loss in investing in stocks, bonds, and other assets. But these rates are already low, so the potential for them to move still lower and the potential for inflation to move still lower is a good deal more limited. Why is that important? Well, as inflation moves down, purchasing power is increased. Your dollar of earnings goes further, and that typically provides a lift to consumer spending. Interest rates go down, it's less costly to finance big-ticket items. We see more of a lift to big-ticket spending on autos, home furnishings, and the like. In this cycle, we've already played that string out, so we're not going to get that added lift. When you marry that with the aftermath of all the turmoil in the financial markets, we think we're looking at a very slow recovery. Despite that, we think that interest rates will be moving up over the next several months. They may not move up right away. The economy is convalescing very slowly. But given the low level of interest rates and what we've seen so far, we think the odds are that rates will be moving up later this year or no later than the early part of next year for at least three reasons. One is already beginning to play itself out. What we're seeing as part of the credit thaw, by definition, is a reflow of money from the Treasury market, the safe haven assets, which is a good thing, out back into other areas of the economy, into the corporate bond market, into the mortgage market, into the municipal market. As money moves out of Treasuries, demand for those securities goes down. If demand goes down, the price goes down, and the yield goes up. It tends to move in opposite directions. Just the opposite is happening everywhere else. Money is moving into those markets, prices are moving up, yields are moving down. And we expect to see that process continue. We've seen Treasury yields move from a low last year, more or less steadily higher over the first seven or so months of this year, and we expect that process to continue. Secondly, as investors become more comfortable with the outlook, more visibility, better visibility, the economy no longer in a free fall, their outlook for inflation becomes less sanguine. That's not to say that they expect inflation to take off. They just don't expect to see serious deflation occurring, where prices are actually declining. As that outlook becomes more stable, interest rates become more elevated from these extraordinary levels. The real wild card out there, and we don't expect that to be played anytime soon, but it is an issue in the intermediate outlook, out beyond the next several months, is the market's reaction to this extraordinary stimulus that we've seen so far. We are dealing with massive budget deficits, and the market has been quite tolerant of those deficits when the economy was weakening and weakening in a big way. The deficit this year, just to put it in perspective, will be more than double the previous record in relation to the economy's size and the size of the financial markets that have to meet it. Back in 1983, first year of a recovery, and I might add that's typical, the deficit peaks in the first year of an economic recovery. The deficit was the equivalent of 6% of the economy's size, and by extension, the size of the financial markets that have to meet it. This year, we expect the deficit to be north of 12%. Borrowing is very aggressive. The government can do that because the private sector is cleared out. This credit freeze, this deep economic slump has reduced private sector credit demand to the point where the government is the only player in town. It's filling a vacuum, and the market's willing to accept that. The real test will come as the economy begins to stabilize, as the activity begins to firm. The betting is that investors will become a bit less tolerant of all the borrowing by the government. They will be demanding that the government begin to pull back, take back some of that liquidity to accommodate, make room for the private sector coming back into the market. The risk is that if the government doesn't pull back quickly enough, and I might add on top of that, the Federal Reserve is actually, politely put, monetizing the deficit, which means that, in effect, they're buying up government securities with money that they and they alone can simply print, create out of thin air. Once again, the market's willing to accept that for now, but as the economy stabilizes, as we get better visibility on the outlook, as investors become less fearful, they begin to look at policy, the longer-term implications, what it means for our borrowing costs, our interest payments on this enormous run-up in debt. And the concern is that the bond market vigilantes, which some of you may remember from the 1980s and early 1990s, bond market vigilantes are investors that start pounding the table, demanding a higher yield, a higher return for parking their money with the government or any other investor because of concern about inflation, begin to drive interest rates up. The presumption has been that the Federal Reserve has full control over when it raises interest rates. The risk is that if the markets become unsettled enough because of concern about government economic policies, a loss of confidence in economic policies, and I might add we've been there before in the 1970s, we had a breakdown, a loss of confidence in the policies of the Federal Reserve and the government at the time, and what we saw were bond yields moving up, foreign investors clearing out of the dollar falling in the foreign exchange markets, forcing the Federal Reserve to move in, reestablish its inflation-fighting credentials by driving up the rates that they can control, which are short-term interest rates. And that could occur prematurely. It could occur before the Fed would like that to happen. Even if we don't have that instability, we do expect to see the Federal Reserve coming in about a year from now and draining money from the financial markets, making room for the private sector coming in, borrowing to meet legitimate investment needs, increase consumer spending. They'll do that initially, we think, by selling government securities, reversal of this quantitative easing that we've seen over the last 6 or 8 months, where the government actually bought securities and pumped money into the financial markets. Some of those windows, those lending windows, are already being shut down. We expect to see more of that during the first half of next year as a prelude to higher interest rates down the road, increases in short-term interest rates. And we do expect to see that occur in the middle and latter part of 2010. In closing, let me just say that, and I've probably spoken longer than I should, I like having a nice big clock in front of me. I can see how I'm running on time, and I do want to save time for questions. We're focused on the near-term outlook. We're focused on the health of the economy, the ability to shake off this severe economic crisis, move ahead. But the longer-term issues are equally important. What is the economy going to look like when the dust settles? How effective, how dynamic an economy will we have? How quickly will we be able to reduce the unemployment rate, which could very well peak at a double-digit rate, a rate we haven't seen since the early 1980s? Now, there are clearly some positives out there. For one thing, we're not grappling with a very harsh economic environment, as I mentioned earlier, that we were dealing with in the 1970s and early 1980s. We don't have double-digit inflation. We don't have interest rates peaking at over 20% as the prime was back in 1980. Inflation is low. Interest rates are subdued. We already have plenty of money in the financial markets that is available for lending as the credit markets continue to thaw. Secondly, there are tremendous opportunities overseas. Foreign trade is already providing a tailwind to the U.S. economy. Our exports are growing at a good clip as the credit thaw continues and extends overseas, and economic stimulus in many of these countries around the world becomes effective in getting jump-starting economies there. And we're already seeing that in Asia, a remarkable recovery. In fact, so strong it's made the front page, the cover page of The Economist. And we're seeing more of that around the world, and the U.S. is benefiting from that. We are seeing exports begin to pick up. This can extend beyond the next year or so. Developing countries, large developing countries like China, India, and parts of Europe do have large domestic markets. We're seeing the rise of a middle class with new demands on consumer goods, on business investment and the like, opening up new opportunities for U.S. exporters. And I might add that the U.S. does have a proven ability to compete in a highly competitive global environment. We're very innovative. We have been over the last 10 or 20 years. We've been very effective in cutting costs in a very harsh economic environment. We've just demonstrated that. Businesses have demonstrated that once again. Productivity growth continuing to hold up well at a time when it's normally plunging because of a weak economic environment. Innovative, a dynamic economy, capable of competing very effectively, much like some of the other developed economies around the world. In fact, we've been one of the better performers until this recession among the industrialized, developed, mature economies globally. Some of these positives are a double-edged sword. The dynamic economy, the global economy that I'm talking about, will create winners and losers, a very unsettling situation. And that does encourage the rise of protectionism. And we've seen some of that in a very weak economic environment. And if this recovery is as weak as we think it will be, that will foster demands for greater protectionism, which is really to nobody's benefit except for the special interests, the industries that tend to benefit from those high trade barriers. Secondly, that ample liquidity that I spoke about, if not handled properly, can create the same sort of speculative excesses that developed over the last couple of years. It will be, and we're already seeing some of that, I might add, in the currency market, in the commodity market, and to some extent in the housing market. Some of that strong demand for homes that we've been seeing is by the same speculators that brought you the froth over the last couple of years, the speculators that got out early enough and made money in the market. Special challenge for the Federal Reserve. It could turn out that monetary policy becomes a good deal more complicated. The Federal Reserve's biggest mistake a few years ago was focusing on goods and services inflation, the CPI, which was very subdued. The problem is when that inflation rate is low and the Federal Reserve is gearing monetary policy, keeping interest rates down in line with that low inflation rate and the corollary, pumping a lot of money into the system, that tends to inflate assets. Financial assets, real estate assets, and the like. What the Fed's challenge will be over the next few years, we think, will be more of a bifurcated policy, focusing not only on goods and services inflation, but controlling asset values. And given that the two tend to move in opposite directions, it will be something of a balancing act. Could create a lot of uncertainty in the financial markets at an extreme, just adding to the volatility there. But it will be a challenge to the Fed and a change, we think, in the direction in economic policy. Finally, perhaps the biggest challenge, the biggest unknown, is how the economy will function in a more heavily regulated, higher tax environment than what we've been accustomed to, an environment in which direct government involvement, direct government control is greater than anything we've seen since the 1930s. To some extent, as I said, we've been there before in the 1970s, a very difficult period for U.S. economic performance. In fairness, back then, the environment was a good deal harsher, more difficult to grow rapidly. But the environment today has its own challenges as well. Much more competitive, not as tolerant of mistakes, policy or otherwise. And that will be the biggest challenge I think we face out over the next couple of years. Growing an economy when the demographics aren't working for us, when population growth begins to wind down, in an environment where we are challenges to productivity, innovation, by a higher tax structure and greater regulation. Well, as I usually say when I finish my talk, I'm out of breath. I probably spoke longer than I should, but I think we still have time for some questions. Let me turn it back over to Stephen, and he'll take it from there. Thank you.
You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California featuring Gary Schlossberg, Vice President and Senior Economist with Wells Capital Management. I'm Stephen Sewer, your moderator for tonight's program, which is part of the For Richer, For Poorer program series presented by Wells Fargo Bank. I invite the audience to submit written questions for Gary. The chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, is a scholar of the Great Depression. Does he deserve credit for averting disaster, and should President Obama appoint him to another term?
Well, I think that to some extent is subjective, but my own take is that certainly mistakes were made, but in fairness to the Federal Reserve, many of these changes were made on the run, on the fly. The Fed had to react to blow-ups in the financial markets, unexpected events. I would rate the chairman very highly. I think fundamentally the most important thing is to act quickly, act aggressively, pump money into the system where it's needed. Certainly there were tactical mistakes made in participating with the Treasury Secretary and the TARP program, the way it was presented to Congress, something at least some individuals thought it would be a fait accompli without an accurate hearing. Admittedly, we didn't really have much time for that. But tactically, I think things could have been done better at times, but I think the policy prescription was right on. The next challenge will be withdrawing that liquidity at the right time in a transparent way so that we don't create uncertainty and volatility in the market. But the innovations, the new facilities that were created, by and large, I think have had the effect of averting a complete collapse in the financial market, and I'd be glad to elaborate on some of those, but we'll leave it at that.
To what degree is the press and the business media and even President Bush, who gave a doomsday speech at the height of the crisis, responsible for the sudden collapse that we experienced?
Well, certainly psychology plays a role in many of these economic cycles. I have to say I've been through a few of them, and the press is always called on the carpet, making a bad situation worse by shouting doom and gloom. I think there's plenty of blame to go around, and I think even if the press was muted, people respond. It's sort of like the consumer sentiment surveys. You get one read. Consumer sentiment does not track well with consumer spending at all. If anything tracks well, it's the expectations component. But it's sort of like a voter exiting the polling booth. They'll tell you one thing after they've voted in the other direction. And very often you see that with the consumer sentiment surveys, psychology. People respond to their own financial situation. And my take is that the hit to household wealth, the pressure on income, concern about job losses in this economic free fall was more than enough to produce the kind of deep recession that we've seen. If comments by the past or current administration have anything to do with it, comments by the press, my guess is, and it's only a guess, that it was marginal more than anything else.
It's so true. I know that in my own personal life, in the fall of 2008, I even started pressing my own shirts. You know, I think everyone contracted at the same time. I think everyone in this room would have a similar story of how they contracted their spending late last year is in response to what was happening. And that was just a complete collapse of the velocity of money. Is America at a competitive disadvantage because we lack national health care?
Do you have an hour? I don't think we're at a competitive disadvantage, certainly from a straight financial situation. And finance is at the top of the list in issues that affect healthcare, but there's so much more involved. Costs can be lower in a national health system, certainly. But I think the issue in front of us is how we get costs under control in our system. Do we go to a national health system? There are other alternatives from an economic standpoint. My guess is that there are more effective ways of going, strictly from a financial area, and it's my take. I mean, this is something that can be debated on end. But there are proposals out there to fix the system within the context that we operate, more of a private sector, that at least in theory would have the effect of reducing costs at least as much, if not more, if you want to look at it strictly in a financial context, than a national health system. Exposing the end user to a greater share of the costs is central. It's a basic tenet of economics, and that would be missing in a national health system. There are other issues as well, but in direct response, I think that you could go either way. You could go with a public health system and hammer down costs as the government becomes the big buyer of those services, or you can work through the market. There's so much more we can do with the existing system to make it more competitive and get costs down as well.
In your closing remarks, you mentioned tax rates. Do tax rates need to rise, and should investment gains be taxed?
Well, you know, we've seen there's a point at which it's detrimental to the economy, and I don't know where that threshold of pain is. But, you know, we could see on the investment side how the economy reacted when the capital gains tax was reduced in 1977. In the midst of a very harsh economic environment, in the midst of a very difficult environment in terms of policies, we did see a big increase in venture capital. And some people would argue that that gave rise to some important innovations, new companies, the high-tech industry did get an important tailwind. The rise in Apple, Microsoft came sometime after those capital gains were reduced. High-taxed economies, generally speaking, do tend to perform less well than lower-taxed economies. And when we talk about high-taxed economies, it is beyond some threshold. I would say on a relative basis that our corporate taxes already are high by international standards. And there's the possibility that they could be raised even more. What you see with tax rates being raised on the individual side is greater sheltering, plowing money into areas that sometimes are arguably less productive than they would be if the system was more transparent. You see the underground economy flourishing more, greater use of cash, which tends to be less efficient. Growth, you could make the argument that growth does suffer as tax rates are raised. And I'm sure if there were two or three other economists here, you'd be getting two or three other opinions on the subject.
43% of foreclosure filings in the first half of the year occurred in just two states, Florida and California.
With good reason.
When do you think California real estate will start to recover?
Well, remarkably, we're already seeing the beginnings of a recovery nationwide. And to some extent, you could even make the same case for California. We've seen home sales begin to pick up. As I said, some of that is speculation. Investors are coming in and buying blocks of these homes, but a lot of it is by the first-time home buyer, which is critical. You've got to feed the base in a housing market, and that base is the first-time home buyer. Ultimately, that first-time home buyer in moving in will begin to firm the market, begin to drive prices up even gradually, and allow the trade-up buyer greater flexibility, greater liquidity in their home, and that frees up the rest of the market. Now, there have been all sorts of incentives out there. There's an $8,000 tax credit for the first-time home buyer nationwide. Here in California, we have a $10,000 tax credit for the purchase of a new home that's certainly contributing to that as well. So some of that's artificial, but a lot of it has to do with the market adjusting. Home prices are down sharply. Affordability is at a 35, 40-year high. We are seeing demand sales pick up. And believe it or not, home prices are beginning to stabilize in some areas as well. The median price, and there are problems with the median price measure, but the median price for a California home is beginning to bottom out, believe it or not. Year over year, those prices are still well down. But sequentially, month to month, those prices are beginning to stabilize and firm a bit in some metro areas here in California. And I might add, outside the state, a growing number of metro areas are beginning to see some price stability as well. Whether it holds remains to be seen. Certainly, in all likelihood, not a prelude to satisfactory increases in home prices and home sales. This is going to be a very long, drawn-out recovery. My guess is we'll be hugging the bottom for quite some time, but by the latter part of 2010, conventional wisdom is we could see more clear-cut signs of an improvement in the housing market nationwide.
Some of the structured vehicles at the root of this crisis are very complicated instruments, the SIVs, the SUVs, whatever they are. The AIG had a lot of them on their books. Has Wall Street grown too complex?
Well, I think it gets back to the point about the environment. I mean, it didn't simply happen. Why now? Why not 5, 10 years ago? We had the computers to devise these products. I think a lot of it has to do with the environment in which we operate in and the institutional structures. This blow-up revealed weaknesses up and down. Clearly, there is a need for some regulation. The concern is that we don't overregulate. Typically, when we come through a financial crisis, whether it's the Great Depression in the early 1930s or after the blow-up, Enron, WorldCom, and earlier in this decade, we come up with a raft of regulations, some of which are effective, FDIC insurance, an effective safety net. Unemployment insurance, which developed in the wake of the Depression, certainly an important safety net as well. Small business, other businesses would argue, and this is debatable, would argue that Sarbanes-Oxley, all the added accounting burdens, have been counterproductive. The added regulations in our exchanges, making our stock exchanges less competitive. We're seeing more IPO activity overseas. Some people would argue that that has been the result of a loss of competitiveness here. To me, a lot of it has to do with the regulatory environment. A lot of it has to do with the economic and financial environment that encourages that type of activity. And I think I don't mean to put the entire burden on the authorities, on officials, but it really starts with an environment that's conducive to economic stability. Mistakes are made. Mistakes were made by banks. Mistakes were made by individuals. But I think the government has to be careful about focusing too much on the financial services sector in these regulations and look to itself to make sure that the risk of these blow-ups is minimized. We're not going to eliminate it, but I think it starts there.
Should mark-to-market be further liberalized?
Mark-to-market, I think, really created a problem during the current environment. I think theoretically there's nothing wrong with mark-to-market accounting, which is to, for certain assets, not all, banks, for example, don't have to mark-to-market their loans on a regular basis. This has more to do with traded securities. And in theory, it certainly makes sense to maintain a current value in the name of transparency for these securities. I think people that criticize this whole mark-to-market structure criticize the fact that it wasn't lifted early enough. When these markets seize up and there's no market and you start seeing a free fall in prices, and traders, participants in the market, have to look to indexes, which can be manipulated by speculators, in driving the price down, that price is not just an accounting situation. It has real, tangible effects on financial institutions and the economy, because when you suffer losses, as banks did, and investors did, it hits their capital. If it hits their capital, they have to pull back on their lending. And that just simply aggravates, produces a vicious circle in the economic slowdown, which is just what happened in this environment. Nobody could anticipate the kind of environment in which mark-to-market accounting may have aggravated the problem. But I think that certainly some adjustments, perhaps temporary, have to be made until the markets are back on their feet. And then we can take a look at the situation out beyond that, perhaps return to the sort of framework we were operating in before the blow-up in the financial markets.
Our members have supplied a number of questions. Was the TARP really necessary, or did we act out of panic?
Well, it's easy to say that we acted out of panic. The economy was in a free fall, the markets were freezing up, and the government was looking for a way to mitigate this collapse or reverse the collapse in the financial markets. What we were trying to do at the time, we being the community, but really the government, was trying to do at the time was take these toxic assets off the books of banks, these assets that were creating the losses that were hitting bank capital and forcing banks to pull back so aggressively in their lending. And they were using, and to some extent, in a very loose way, the model that was so successful in the aftermath of the savings and loan crisis. Some of you may remember the Resolution Trust Corporation, which basically took assets from failed institutions, by and large commercial real estate and mortgage securities that were tied to them. and put them into a bad bank, the Resolution Trust Corporation, as the umbrella, and eventually sold off those securities and cut their losses to some extent. That's the one area that hasn't really worked that effectively of all the government programs that have dealt with the financial markets. We have funding programs that have worked very well, low-cost funding to try to jumpstart the market. We have direct lending windows. We have guarantees that have helped work, get the commercial paper market back on its feet. TARP and its successor, this PPIP program, public-private investor, you make the call. I can't remember what the acronym is. But tried to model, at least in theory, what we did with the RTC. The problem, as I see it, was twofold. First of all, you're not taking assets off of failed institutions. You're taking them, you're buying them from an ongoing institution. Might be a zombie bank, but it's still an ongoing institution. So a price has to be negotiated. And institutions might not want to sell because of concern about the losses that would be incurred. Not only on those securities, but if you start establishing a market and you're taking a 70% hit, then any asset similar to that takes a 70% hit as well, and the effect begins to ripple through. Secondly, the assets are a lot more complicated, a lot less transparent, a lot more opaque than the commercial real estate and mortgage-backed security assets that were taken up by the RTC. The process was a whole lot more complicated, and frankly, even with added support from the government providing low-cost financing so that private investors can lever up those investments and accept a higher price in transacting. Despite all that, the program really has not gotten off the ground. But the intent was certainly there. The money did go toward shoring up capital, which had a reasonably calming effect on the financial markets to some extent. But it didn't serve its original purpose, which in theory could have gone a long way toward easing the crisis.
The American dream traditionally included owning real estate. Do you believe that this is still true, or has the new tighter credit environment killed that dream?
Well, for now, I think it may have killed the dream, although I think it's killed it more in areas where you can't qualify for a conventional mortgage. The conventional mortgage financing is certainly, it's not back to where it was, but it's certainly more readily available than financing is in a market like California, where a good part of the state has mortgages that tend to be non-qualifying. That part of the market is probably still among the hardest hit by this credit freeze. Private label mortgages that provide provide the funding for these jumbo non-conventional mortgages is still very tight, and that has acted as an impediment to some extent in the higher cost areas around the country. Whether or not that dream is dashed longer term remains to be seen. If home prices don't rise rapidly, the attraction of houses as an investment vehicle may not be there. So the demand for houses may not be as strong as it was before. There is the tax angle, and I think to owning a home, costs tend to be a bit lower than they are over time after taxes, all in, for some types of rentals. And as the market heals, I think certainly that funding will be available, and households will have the opportunity, I think, once again, to own a home. It's a question of how strong the demand is for houses as an investment vehicle.
What about the next wave of mortgage resets? Will that further drive down real estate, especially in California?
Well, we don't expect to see the recovery take place in a straight line. A lot of it has to do with the outlook for the economy. It is going to be a weak recovery. A lot of it has to do with funding availability, and a lot of it has to do with mortgage resets, foreclosure activity, even without the resets. And we expect to see two or three bump ups in interest rates, which will squeeze households further. And that will have a disruptive effect on the recovery. We still look for a housing recovery, but later this year and again, at least one more time in 2010, we do get a reset of some of these adjustable rate mortgages. The key is what are the financing alternatives? How low will fixed rate mortgages be? I'm not sure we're going to get the relief we need there. Those rates could be as high, if not a little bit higher, than they are now. And that means that we will see foreclosure activity continue to weigh on the market. I don't think it's a game changer, but it will have a dampening effect on the recovery in sales and, along with that, home values.
As an economist, how do you feel Obama is doing?
Well, that's a political question as much as anything else. I think he's certainly addressing the tough issues. He may be doing too much too soon. The argument is that if you don't do it now, the opportunity is lost. There are a lot of big issues that the administration is tackling at one time, issues that perhaps really have to be discussed more thoroughly. In any event, the voters have to decide how effective all that has been. My own feeling is I have a bias more toward market-oriented solutions, and certainly this government is really more inclined toward government solutions. So to that extent, I would say as an alternative, I would look for policy moving in another direction. But certainly tackling the tough issues, the goals are certainly well-intentioned. How am I doing? I'm trying to be as balanced as I can.
You're breaking a sweat.
There are problems that need to be solved, and the administration is tackling them head on. The concern is that there's too much too soon, and as an economist, and these are debatable, but as an economist, I feel that the bias toward government control, government involvement, is excessive. I think that the private sector represents a tremendous opportunity, a tremendous lever to deal with the problems. Nothing wrong with the goals, but the means of achieving those goals, I think, can be handled so much more effectively by working with the private sector rather than working around them or through them, through direct government involvement.
What are the prospects for hyperinflation?
Well, the bigger issue right now is deflation, the concern about an outright decline in prices. In fact, the Consumer Price Index is dropping at a rate unlike anything we've seen in the last 40 or 50 years, largely because of what we call good deflation. That is, energy prices, food prices coming down. We're primarily an energy consumer, obviously a consumer of food. We do sell commodities overseas, but on balance, it's been a plus for the U.S. The concern is if other prices, the other 70% of the CPI outside of food and energy, those prices move lower, that's bad deflation. Consumers postpone purchases, waiting for prices to come down. Incomes tend to be cut because businesses are feeling a squeeze on their revenues. People with fixed-rate debt tend to suffer more because their incomes are going down rather than the debt that they're dealing with. So that's what we're fixed on right now. Certainly the ingredients are there for higher inflation down the road. We have a lot of money in the system, and if the Fed doesn't drain that money as the private sector begins to come back quickly, the concern can develop about too much money chasing too few goods. And in fact, too much money can chase too few goods, and inflation can move up. And the other aspect is the more regulated environment. I hate to keep coming back to that, but with heavier regulation, with tougher barriers to entry at times, you could see a less efficient economy, an economy that's less capable of cutting costs in response to a more difficult environment. And the risk of cost push inflation, like we had in the 1970s, could reemerge in that kind of environment. So you don't want to be complacent about the risk of inflation. If you become complacent, eventually it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. But I would say that that's really tomorrow's story rather than today's. There's so much excess capacity out there. Competition in the global economy is so great. The bigger issue is, are prices going to be declining rather than moving up?
The next question is a two-part question. The first part's just yes or no. Do you believe that global warming is real?
You know, when you asked me to do this, you said something about softballs, no hardballs. I mean, these are questions you can go on and on about. You know, it's difficult to say whether or not global warming. I'm not a scientist, and I'm not even sure I'm an economist at times. The issues are difficult enough. But I will say that if you do assume, and that's what economists do, they assume certain things, and then they go from there. If you assume that global warming is an issue, the next issue is how best to deal with the problem. You want to minimize the distortions in the private sector. And once again, our concern, I think, is that among the proposed solutions, something like cap and trade, where Europe is already does have that system already in place, has created some problems, creates a lot of revenues, creates a lot of distortions in the economy, creates revenues for the government, which may or may not be spent efficiently, but does create distortions in the economy. There are winners and losers. Most economists propose, or at least many economists propose, some sort of carbon tax on a broad array of sectors of the economy, trying to even it out a bit more, trying to make it more pervasive. But I think that's really the issue that has to be debated. How best to deal with the problem once you decide that the problem is actually out there? And I might add that the problem itself is still being debated. Many experts in the field are still questioning just how serious a problem, not so much serious a problem. I mean, it's obvious that we have global warming, but how much has been caused by industrialization? And the risk is that if you overreact to it, and I'm not arguing one way or the other, but if you overreact to that with heavy-handed regulation, the costs involved might be greater than the costs of global warming itself. And I'm sure if I ask for a show of hands on how many people are on the other side of that question, the vast majority would be raising them. But I think that's one issue. The other issue is how best to deal with it in an economically neutral way that maximizes economic growth.
Well, you nailed the second part of that question.
Thank God. Don't ask it.
What investments will produce the best returns over the next 3 years?
Best returns over the next 3 years. Well, where we are in the economic cycle, and many of us are firm believers in this economic cycle. History doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but at least as Mark Twain was credited with saying, it rhymes. And there are similarities in the way the economy behaves, the interrelationships. And coming out of a recession, there are certain things that do tend to happen. For one thing, profits tend to grow a bit more rapidly. They may not explode the way they normally do after a severe recession, but they do tend to grow more rapidly. That's good news for the stock market. So as a starter, we would tend to be overweighted in stocks. When I say overweighted, I think as an investor, what you have to start out with is an array of assets. And people do debate that. They say that's what got us into this mess. But we're still firm believer in a diversified portfolio. A diversified portfolio with a mix that's consistent with your risk tolerance helps you sleep at night. Some people can sleep very well with 100% of junk bonds. They don't mind the big price swings. Other people can't tolerate that at all. And also consistent with your time horizon. Do you need it for retirement? Do you need it for the educational needs of your family in another year or two? So that determines where things are. But I would say that with that as a starting point, and with a certain allocation that you're comfortable with, we would overweight stocks in this kind of environment. We would overweight stocks in what we call economically sensitive areas of the economy, materials producers, big-ticket consumer goods, investment goods, those areas of the economy that do best as the economy is beginning to recover. Corporate bonds, quality corporate bonds, tend to do well. Stay away from treasuries. Treasuries are today's asset bubble. We've already seen big losses there, but that flight to quality drove those prices up, those interest rates down. That money is going to go somewhere at some point. It already has. As it moves out, it drives the prices down, and you suffer losses as an investor. Real estate, I think, is still early in its adjustment process. The bell doesn't go off when it hits bottom, but we think the bottom is still a ways off. Housing can be a good investment down the road, but we think there's still an adjustment process there as well. Financial assets that are sensitive to the economic cycle, like corporate bonds, stocks. I might add, muni investors are still looking at very attractive yields on municipal securities, particularly longer-term securities. Typically, a muni yield on a long-term muni bond is 90% of the yield on a long-term treasury. And the reason for that is that you have a tax advantage, so you're willing to accept a lower yield. Currently, the muni yield as of last week on the yield I look at is 105% of treasury yields. Still a very attractive yield before tax adjustments and certainly after tax adjustments. On a high-quality general obligation muni bond, which means that the full revenue base of the state is behind that bond. The risk of default, never say never, especially here in California, but the risk of default is that much lower. You stay away from the specified purpose, state, the local county bonds to some extent. You really have to do your homework there. But on the high-quality munis, still some attractive opportunities.
We've reached the point in the program where we have time for just one more question, and it's a good one to wrap up with. What is the biggest lesson we've learned from this crisis?
Don't be complacent. Don't assume that because we've managed to avoid crises in the past, that we can avoid them in the future. The economy is remarkably resilient. It's shown an extraordinary flexibility to shocks in the past as well. Not necessarily the Great Depression, although even there, people lose sight of the fact that in the midst of the Depression, we tend to think of it as a 10-year-long walk in the desert. But the fact of the matter is that the government did the right things early on. We cut taxes. We increased spending. We flooded the market with liquidity, with money. The Federal Reserve did. And there was a period in late 1933 to early 1937 where the economy was averaging double-digit economic growth. It didn't feel like a recovery because the hole that we had dug for ourselves right after the stock market crash was so deep. By early 1937, Social Security taxes began to kick in. We formed Social Security in 1935. Reserve requirements were raised. That meant banks had to pull back in their lending. Tax rates, if you look at the actual published tax rates, they actually went up in 1936, early 37. All the Smoot-Hawley tariff, that the tariff increases that we enacted in 1934. Finally, our trading partners began to retaliate. Tariffs went up. World trade collapsed. And we went into another severe economic slump. But the point is that you don't want to be complacent. You want to keep your eye on the ball as far as economic policy is concerned, regulations are concerned. And as investors, you want to try to avoid being caught up in the heat of the moment. Housing prices, for example, don't grow to the sky. They don't continue to rise at a double-digit rate. You have to know when to pull back as an individual, as an investor, as a business person. And there were people that did that, that are benefiting because they have cash. Cash is king in this kind of economy right now, and they're the ones that are best positioned to benefit from the opportunities that develop.
Thanks to our speaker, Gary Schlossberg, for his participation in the For Richer, For Poorer series. I would also like to thank our listening audience, both here and on radio, for your attention here this evening. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating 106 years of enlightened discussion is adjourned.